Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank the organizers for the opportunity to speak. An outline of what I want to tell you about is here. First, the kind of grand vision of wouldn't it be nice? And then a couple of, well, the main part of the talk, discussions of, well, let's go down in the lab and see what things really look like down and dirty. The first is trapping single atoms in a cavity, and the second is how that might relate to continuous quantum variables. So the kind of unifying theme we want to tell you about are quantum networks, kind of depicted here. Some node where we have a little quantum processor, a little quantum computer, you know, a few bits or thousands of qubits, and then somehow another processor, and we want those to be able to communicate with each other fully, coherently, quantum mechanically. That is, we'd like to be able to access any state in the combined state Hilbert space of that whole system. And the way I've drawn it is in terms of, well, here's California, so you might think of some internet, a quantum internet, for which there's not yet an IPO. But you should also think of this, well, what if this were itself inside a small quantum computer? Well, a quantum computer we want to make big. At any stage in the technical development of quantum information, there's going to be some largest size processor we can make, and we either stick with that or we actually learn to wire them up quantum mechanically. So from a practical perspective, you can think of either this large-scale networks and quantum cryptography, perhaps quantum networks, or smaller-scale wiring up quantum computers with such networks. From a physics perspective, I'm actually quite interested in these things to try to understand things like metrology and measurement. That is, if this is somebody here who's trying to not use this channel to communicate, but there's actually something in the channel you want to measure, an atomic sample, spectroscopy, and I'd like to know how to measure the properties of that channel better than some standard quantum limits. So from a variety of perspectives, this is an interesting paradigm for investigating quantum information. I remind you of, on the one hand, computational complexity and communication complexity and how those are increasingly getting intertwined. So that's where we're trying to go. Not to do Shor's algorithm for some very distant perspective, maybe never, but to learn how to build small networks. And the setting in which I'll describe today is the quantum nodes are going to be cavities with a few atoms, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, as the node, and there are protocols for how to entangle those atoms to do arbitrary transformations. And then when this node needs to talk to that node, we'll convert the information in one of these atoms into a photon, send it, and coherently receive it. And the protocols for doing that have been worked out by Peter Zoller, Ignacio Serac collaborators. And just to emphasize the notion that if you can entangle this whole thing instead of having these working independently, in which case the state space looks like that, there's an exponential win that will overcome whatever, you know, resources requires to wire these up. There's some overhead associated with doing that. So real protocols for how to do this within the setting of cavity quantum electrodynamics, again, have been worked out by Ignacio Serac collaborators, including how to do it in a fully error-corrected way. And the basic idea now in a little bit more detail is to take an atom in a cavity. Here, this is ground state, so these are just hyperfine levels, spin levels, like in the presentation of Bruce Kane, very long-lived, now an atom in free space, and this is the electronic transition of about 1 eV. And the idea is, coupled to the cavity through this coupling coefficient G, which I'll describe more in just a moment, the idea, for example, if we want to make a single photon, is if the atom's here, is to put on some external field, we just shine in and address this atom, go, just imagine for the moment, to this excited state, and then decay, and if G is big enough, the decay will not happen out here, it'll happen in the cavity mode, then it's out. And now when it gets down to here, remarkably, these mirrors I'll show you have reflectivities of 0.999996, and you would think that the field just bounces off, but in fact you can reverse this process and absorb it there. So that's transfer of one photon, but more importantly, if this is in a superposition state, you can send that unknown superposition state, you can send that superposition state there. If it doesn't succeed, you can figure out it didn't succeed, do it again, it's error corrected in ways that Stephen Van Eyck and Zoller and Serac have worked out. Moreover, if this whole system is entangled, then you can take one component of it and transfer it to there. So now, if these five atoms were entangled, you can take that component of the wave function, send it down here, and now this atom will be entangled. entangle with those. So, at least in principle, but fairly realistic analyses of all the relaxation and interaction processes are pretty well known in cavity QED. One knows how to do that, and that's what we're working towards. And taking this apart yet a further step, you see in that previous thing, they're going to be bit carriers, which are photons, and now they could interact via matter. And we did an experiment some years ago that in another guise, what is this all about, quantum computing? Well, and from the perspective of optical physics, it's learning how to do nonlinear optics with one photon. So a Kerr nonlinearity at the level of a single photon suffices for universal quantum logic. On the other hand, if the information carriers are these spin states, internal states of atoms, then you can wire the thing together, as demonstrated by Serac, Zoller, and colleagues, by photons. And putting those two things together lets you then build up towards this communication network. So then finally, what's the real nitty-gritty? Well, there's going to be an atom, and now just consider the ground state and excited state, and for the time being, forget about this hyperfine levels. The coupling is between a ground state of the atom and cesium 6s state and an excited state 6p state. And the idea is that if you put the electron up here, about an eV up, 850 nanometers, the atom can decay and emit a photon into the cavity. And if it's in the cavity, it could be reabsorbed. And the rate at which that happens, just the coupling and the interaction Hamiltonian, I'll call G. So that's the good news. The G characterizes what's called the one photon Rabi frequency. On the other hand, if the atom were up here, it could decay and then be lost, spontaneous emission, essentially the Einstein A coefficient. And if the photon's in the cavity, it could go out there, and that's just the cavity decay, and that's bad. So the idea is to achieve what I call strong coupling, where this rate dominates all the other rates, the spontaneous emission rate, the cavity decay rate, and indeed the atom may decide to leave. Unlike condensed matter physics, you put it in there and it stays, the atoms in free space are going to leave, so this is all in the vacuum. So we want this rate to be big compared to all of those, and one can introduce some more physical significant parameters, and what I call the critical photon number, which is just some dissipative rate, which is the faster of the spontaneous rate or the transit. It's just the rate at which the atom information leaves, and that characterizes the critical photon number. And for the experiments I'll tell you about, that's 10 to the minus 4, which is to say 10 to the minus 4 of a quantum in this cavity begins to drive nonlinear processes. And so one photon's a big deal. And another combination of parameters is this. It's just dissipation divided by coherence. That needs to be very small, so indeed one atom is a big deal. So if you put one atom in this cavity, think about the light bouncing back and forth, the atom is important both with respect to dispersion and absorption. So you got to get those numbers small in the context of cavity QED. It's this critical atom and photon number in the context of condensed matter physics. There's a critical phonon number, a critical electron number, a critical whatever your flux quantum, whatever your favorite thing is. And those critical numbers have to be very small so that when you end up with one unit, you can do things coherently relative to the dissipative rates. So those are the key parameters I'll tell you about. So, and that's about the only two. There's one more you need to know. So that's where one is striving. And over the years, we've managed to get these things fairly small. And that's necessary, but certainly not sufficient for doing all these, you know, miraculous things, getting those things small. So just as an aside, there was this beautiful work that we heard about yesterday from Manny Neal and his collaborators about quantum information processing with linear optics, but you need single photon sources and detectors. And in fact, that's a kind of easy part of this protocol. We haven't done it yet, but on the road to Mount Olympus, this is an easy part. An atom in a cavity, these external control fields, if you can distribute this entanglement, one can certainly make single photons, and that's actually fairly straightforward in terms of internal states. In cesium, one particular example, if you drive it up to here, it will decay to here and then out. And one can control not only the fact that, well, a photon leaves, but you can actually control the envelope. And you just dial in what you want, like in a synthesizer. And one should be able to do that very well for the kind of experimental parameters you ought to be able to make in initial experiments, kind of 90%, and there's already experiments being done in this setting by Gerd Rimpa's group. So making single photon sources, detecting them, just run this thing backwards. It's actually fairly straightforward. Well, we haven't done it yet, but relative to these other tasks. So A problem in all of this, I've been drawing these cavities, putting the atom there. No group in the world has yet succeeded in putting these atoms right where you want them in this domain of strong coupling. Kind of indefinitely there, cooled to the motional ground state. So there's a lot of work underway by various avenues. My colleague Hideo Mabuchi is trying to use a magnetic field. So here's a cavity, and we're going to hold the atom. So hold the atom by magnetic fields. Mike Chapman at Georgia Tech is using a CO2 laser, light forces. I'll tell you more about that. Reiner Blott is trying to use the mirrors of a cavity are here, and this contraption here is an ion trap. So using electrostatic fields, RF fields and a Paul trap to confine the atom, as is Herbert Walter's group. There's a number of groups around the world trying to confine single atoms, ions. An ion, I think, is acceptable, except that it's charged particle. So the technique that we've been following is here. Can somebody turn those lights off that shine right on the screen? Does somebody know how to do that? Is to combine, laser cooling and trapping you've all heard about. No, that's the wrong one, Natasha. It's these lights. Combine laser cooling and trapping. Now, that's exactly the factorial search problem. Now, it's these lights right here. Okay. So we'll go with what we got. There you go. Those are off, but turn some others back on or people will go to sleep. Combine laser cooling and trapping. So we use light forces to localize the atoms in cavities. And this is what it looks like. Little mirrors. I'll show you more about them. Cold atoms. Cold means 100 microkelvins, 10 microkelvin. Millimeter scale, drop the atoms and try to catch them in here and hold them with light forces. So this is the cavity axis, this is the standing wave structure, and try to hold the atoms. And so shine light into these mirrors, figure out what's going on by looking at the transmitted light. The atomic motion inside of here profoundly affects the cavity field, as I described before. So by looking out here, we can try to infer what's going on inside of there. And that's the story I'll tell you now for quite a while. Some of the technical aspects of that, which are actually quite interesting in their own rights, and we'd be pursuing independent of all this quantum information stuff. So this is what the experiments look like. Two different experiments I'll tell you about. And these are the set of people that are actively involved in them. In this experiment, the current set of people right now are Joe Buck and Jason McKeever. So these are what the cavities look like. There are these mirrors here. You can't actually see the gap. The gap is here in the experiments I'll tell you about. It's 10 to 50 microns long and tens of microns like that, 15 microns. And the light bounces back and forth in there a lot, several hundred thousand times. And this whole thing goes in a vacuum chamber, and now we put cold atoms here and we try to bleed them in one by one. And some of the technical aspects about the experiment that I won't talk about much at all is to isolate this thing very, very well from external disturbances and then servo control the length because we're sensitive because the finesse is so high we have to control the length of the cavity to about a Fermi. And I'll show you some data later on to show that if you actually put one KT of energy in an elastic mode of the cylinder, that actually affects the cavity QED physics we're trying to do. So on the one hand, that's really neat physics. On the other hand, it might dissuade investors in our internet IPO. So here's the kind of physics we're trying to do. This strong coupling, in other words, is there's a ground state of the atom in the cavity, and there's an excited state. The excited state is, there's one photon in the system and the atom's in the ground state, or the atom's in the excited state with no quanta. So that's the first excited state of the composite system. And those two possibilities are degenerate if we're outside of the cavity. So think of this dimension as the spatial dimension in the stuff I'll show you. This could be down. So gravity's going that way. And as an atom falls in the cavity, it actually finds that there's no interaction energy. And as it moves into the cavity, then enter a region where there is an interaction region. And that interaction, then there's the splitting, which is just the normal mode splitting associated with two oscillators, in this case, the atom and the cavity. Now, what I told you before about strong coupling is that this G be big compared to the dissipative rate. So you can just think of that as some your favorite set of energy levels. Where now the coherent coupling, that's the splitting, is big compared to the widths of the levels. And that's what we've been able to do for, a decade. And now what we're trying to do is a situation where the atomic kinetic energy is small compared to this splitting. So H bar G expressed as a temperature is about 5 millikelvin in our temperatures, in our experiments. And that's a very big energy compared to, it's actually completely trivial to cool things to 100 microkelvin. It's straightforward to cool things to a few microkelvin. So this energy here is really big compared to the atomic kinetic energy. What that means is that the spatial dependence, this is the standing wave structure, this is a radial structure, that it, when an atom moves around inside of here, the coupling energy is changing, and one can actually use that, associated with single quanta in the system, to trap the atom in the cavity. And that's what I want to show you. And the trapping, if you think in terms of this level diagram, if we excite to here, we're essentially making a molecule of the covalently bonded between the atom and the cavity, where now the covalent bonding is between the photon and the atom. So that's what we're trying to do, to bind the system on this potential surface. And to try to figure out what's going on, we're going to drop an atom into the cavity. And as the atom then comes, instead of falling through, as it enters the cavity, we're actually going to sense its presence. It changes the transmitted field. And then we'll turn on to try to excite to the pseudo-potential to then trap the atom. And the way we figure out what's going on is that when the atom moves around inside the cavity, the field changes. When the atom moves out of the cavity, the transmission in this particular setting goes down. And when the atom moves into the center of the cavity, it goes up. That's just because the atom is acting like a little glass bead, dispersively tuning the cavity in and out of resonance. When it comes into the middle of the cavity, it increases the transmission. When it goes to the side of the cavity, it decreases it. So by looking at this photocurrent, we can figure out something, that there's an atom there swiggling around. In fact, we can do better than that by a procedure I won't tell you much in detail. But the photocurrent in a heterodyne detector in these experiments, we can go back to figure out what the field is, propagate on the table. We can then go through the mirrors to find out what the intercavity field is. Given that, we can actually effectively invert the master equation for this system to find out what the coupling is at some particular moment of time. And since we know the geometry of the cavity mode, we can then find the radial position as a function of time. In addition, we actually know this pseudo-potential from the solution of the master equation. And I won't tell you about, unless you're interested, how we go about figuring out that we really know it and confirming that we know it. But if you know the rate, just think of the solar system, if you know the radius is a function of time and you know the potential is a function of time, you can actually reconstruct the trajectory. So what I'll show you is how to reconstruct. An atom's going to fall in. This is the cavity mode. We're going to take this cavity like this, slice it like this. The atom is localized for reasons I could discuss at an antinode. So here's the cavity. Here's the standing wave structure. We're going to slice like that, and then we're going to look at it like that. So an atom is going to fall in, and then what I'm going to show you is, from the photocurrent, what the inference of the atomic motion is. So it's like a microscope. We look over here, there's some complicated transfer function, which is not Fourier optics here, but it's through this master equation to sense the atomic motion. And this is what you get when you do that. So down here is the actual transmission as a function of time. It's about a millisecond. So the movie is slowed down 1,000 times, actually about 10,000 times. The atom falls in, you're sliced in this plane. We actually sense that it's there, we turn on this potential, and now it's actually bound in orbit with this, on average, one photon, and there's the trajectory moving around. This dimension here is about the 10 microns the cavity waste. So there's one example. There's another one. Now you notice, unlike the solar system, it's not this ellipse, but it actually precesses. And that's due to the fact we have one photon, and so the fluctuations in one are large, and so there's actually spontaneous forces which cause diffusion, which make this ellipsis effectively precess. So we call that the atom cavity microscope, and I actually believe it's a new kind of microscopy. It's something that you couldn't do otherwise, for in reasons I'll explain in just a moment. The sensitivity are shown here, about 10 to the minus 5 to get a signal to noise ratio of 1. And the measurements I showed you, that ball represents the uncertainty and the ability to infer where the atom is. So this is an actual in here, an actual reconstructed trajectory. Falling in triggers on, that's the actual rasness, the motion then leaves. And this is the cavity. And in those movies, the ball, it stayed the same size, but in fact it should be getting bigger. If we can improve the sensitivity about a factor of 3, which is actually fairly straightforward, we catch, if there's a photon in here, we catch it with about 25% efficiency, and we need to move that up towards 70 or 80%. If we do that, then the ball ought to get bigger. And the reason the ball gets bigger is because we're near the standard quantum limit for sensing the atomic motion. So the fact that we looked at it with some sensitivity implies a back action. So on the one hand, the ball should get bigger as the movie progresses. On the other hand, we know what the back action is. So if we take account of that, we ought to be able to subtract that off and keep the ball the same size. So the whole point of quantum measurement with back action, we ought to be able to investigate that, I think, in an interesting way. So on the one hand, there's this trapping with single photons, which is kind of novel, but I don't think that's really the point. The point that I would try to emphasize is this so-called optical information. We have this system and we're trying to learn about it by looking at it. And so here's an atom in a cavity. If the atom's not in the cavity, we get some transmitted field. Here's the Lorentzian transmission of this resonant cavity. And when the atom comes in fact, this is this normal mode structure I've been talking about, this splitting associated with ground state and then splitting. And the change in this structure relative to that is the information we have about whether the atom's there or not and the atomic motion. And one can try to do a little simple calculation about, well, how much flux is changed at, say, at this point when the atom's not there, and when the atom is there, there's a change in flux, and that's our ability then to see. And try to understand, well, how much what is the rate at which information about the system is being produced? And you can calculate that. It turns out to be this quantity, g squared over kappa is the rate, then times the time is essentially the number of bits we have to tell about this atom. And in previous work in cavity QED, in my group and the groups around the world, Professors Hiroshi and Walter with atomic beams, that's about one. The atom goes through and you get one bit of information. And as realized in those movies I just showed, it's about 10 to the 7. That is, there's a, never mind this binding with one photon, that's kind of novel. But this is, I think, actually fundamentally important in addressing one's ability to sense what's going on in open quantum systems. And just to show you in a different context, if I had this atom and I tried to do traditional microscopy by, I'm going to collect all the fluorescence in 4 pi, and I'm going to do that with 100% quantum efficiency, then the rate that you could learn about the atomic motion is just the Einstein-A coefficient, that's about 10 to the 7 for this particular transition in cesium. And in cavity QED, it's 100 times bigger for the little cavity I showed you. So there's actually an understanding in principle, how much information can you get? And there's some work by these gentlemen related to that, which relates this toy model to actually the rate at which the system makes entropy in the external world. So where can we go from here? Well, there's been some beautiful work done by Milburn, Wiseman, my colleague Hideo Mabuchi about quantum feedback. And the toy model we want to pursue is, here's this cesium atom dancing around in there. We want to detect somehow, and we want to make an estimate of what the thing's doing, what the atom's doing. Based on that estimate, we want to feedback, and if it's not doing what we want it to do, modulate the frequency, the intensity, to get it to do what we want it to do. And the interesting conceptual problems are, well, what is the measurement you're supposed to make to get optimal estimate of the state of the atomic motion? And even if you, and that's an unresolved theoretical problem, even if I gave you that optimal estimate, what would you do optimally to say, put this thing, not the marble in the bottom of the dish, but to engineer some particular wave packet state? And so I think there are a number of really exciting conceptual issues in again, this very simple setting, but something where we have a lot to learn about, in this case, quantum feedback control, which I think quantum error correction is actually subsumed by the more general concept of quantum feedback control. How you actually do this in the lab is a little bit complicated, and I won't go into that unless you're interested. It's techniques that Hideo Mabuchi has been pioneering. We have to essentially, in real time, be inverting this master equation to get the control signal. So that's experimentally a lot of fun, independent of these highbrow ideas. So here's another idea for how to trap an atom in a cavity. That was this one photon stuff. Again, if we have light forces, spatially varying fields in the cavity, if we have an atomic transition like this, an electron volt, and as we start to tune the excitation frequency farther and farther and farther below resonance, well, finally, you know, when you get down to 60 hertz, then you're just dealing with the DC susceptibility, polarizability. And below resonance, then there's effectively just a Ponder motive potential that can be used to trap the atom. The atom's attracted to regions of high intensity. And it's just a classical, forget this one photon stuff, classical trapping potential. So what we want to have then is a standing wave of the cavity, and then the atom localized, this is the trapping potential, this is cavity QED, localized in one of these wells. And then finally get to the point of looking at the quantum structure associated with that. So the idea of what we've been trying to do in the lab is a probing field tells us an atom's coming, and when it gets in the middle, turn on this classical trapping potential. And you can do that. In comes the atom. This is Kabi-QED field. In comes the atom. Boom, the atom's falling in. You see the transmission drop, high signal to noise. As soon as the horse gets in the corral, you close the gate. Everybody in Texas knows that. And then when you want to ride, you let out. So you see if the atom's still there. And if you do that over and over again, you can build up the lifetime of this. In this particular case, it's 100 milliseconds or so, a tenth of a second for the lifetime of the atom. The previous single photon stuff, single photons imply large fluctuations, and those were down in hundreds of microseconds, and now this is whatever, two or three orders of magnitude better. It's still a little bit disappointing, however, because the photon scattering rate for this should be actually flat if you just go calculate in the standard book how long this ought to stay. And so what are the heating mechanisms? I won't go through that. We've spent 2 years in fairly intense technical investigations, technical hell, plumbing. But one of the interesting aspects of what limits the lifetime, and I'll describe to you, is the following. So here's one of these little cavities that's mounted, and then there's some vibration isolation stack. So right there, those two surfaces, about, in this case, 40 microns apart, that's the thing we're interested in. And the question is, when this light comes into this cavity, it's a high finesse resonator, light bounces back a lot. If the mirrors are moving, if things are jiggling, then we can actually see that because there's this cavity moving and we have a constant frequency, and so this motion turns into intensity noise. And you can measure that, and here's what it looks like. So this is the intensity noise measured over here to try and infer what's going on there. And it's this jiggly red trace, and the frequencies extend out. This is about a megahertz. And the relevance of that is the motion of the atom in the trap is a couple of megahertz, 1 or 2 megahertz. And so there is noise there, which parametrically, if you're in a trapping potential and the potential is going like that, you parametrically heat the thing out. So that's the noise of this laser in this high finesse cavity, high Q cavity. What's the blue trace? The blue trace is if you take a right circular cylinder and you put KT of energy into each one of these longitudinal modes, just this kind of mode of the cylinder, then that's what you get. And you see it lines up kind of nicely. So maybe that's a hint. So let's go think about thermal noise. Let's solve the, first of all, continuum mechanics problem, which everybody was supposed to have done as an undergraduate physics major. I never did. I ran from these things like from a burning house. They were solved not in the last century, but the previous century by Lord Rayleigh, at least in some approximation. And you can learn about, well, that's a simple problem, right? No, you don't want to know. It's really complicated. But you can solve for all these modes and put them together, and if you do that for something that's kind of like our little mirrors, this is the spectrum of thermal noise. So there are these high Q, the Q is about 100. Here are the individual modes, and just like for any kind of problem, modes in a box, as you go to higher and higher frequency relative to the cutoff frequency for a given Q, then the modes kind of merge into a continuum, and that's what you see happening here. And the interesting thing to do is look at this axis. It's 5 × 10⁻¹⁷ meters per root hertz. That means if you look for a second, the thing will have moved 0.05 Fermi. So 5 × 10⁻¹⁷ meters. So it's not a big, not a lot, but it's actually important in heating the motion of the atom. You can put all that together as shown here. The red is what we measure, and the blue is the calculation, and there's no adjustable parameter except for the Q. We don't know that a priori. So we fit the Q for one mode and then everything else. And you see the mode density work. Some of these modes match really well. Some of them don't match so well. But that's because our mirrors look like this. They're not right circular cylinders. So we're actually doing a finite element analysis in collaboration with Dennis Coyne and the LIGO project to actually get all the frequencies. So now it becomes like molecular spectroscopy. So to match those up. But the scientific directions are, well, what if we can see this, we see it with very high signal to noise, with very low powers, we ought to be able to actually feedback and cool selective modes of excitation. And it's also possible, although not in the current setting, with higher Q resonators, to actually treat these things, not the atom, but the masses themselves, which are about 100 milligrams, as a quantum mechanical object, and see if we can do interesting things with that. And I would point out in that regard this beautiful work by the group in Paris and the group in Constant. This group has actually already implemented some of these ideas, feedback control of these elastic modes. In the context of cavity QED, the idea is, well, what do you do about this? Give up. This resonator has a very high finesse at the wavelength of where we were doing this, and if we move to a different wavelength, the finesse drops, this noise drops as the square of that finesse, And that's the way to get to circumvent it. So by one avenue or another, either light forces I've been telling you about, or ion traps, as Professor Blotton and Professor Walter have been pursuing, we get these atoms trapped, and we have to learn how to then deal with the quantized center mass motion. For the moment, these are just marbles rolling around, but finally we'll deal with the wave packets cooling down the ground state. So now we have this harmonic oscillator. The optical field is a harmonic oscillator, so we have two coupled harmonic oscillators. And one should be able to make motional states of this oscillator, write them into the cavity field, and make interesting states of light. This is just the Wigner distribution for superposition of two coherent states. And having made states like that, it should be possible to take these states and reversibly put them into the atomic motion. So in the beginning, I was telling you about atomic internal states for bits and qubits, and now I've moved to, well, what about continuous degrees of freedom and harmonic oscillators? And it should be possible to do the same kind of quantum state exchange of light to motion and conversely. So now let me digress a little bit to tell you about the quantum mechanics of those continuous quantum variables, not spin variables, but harmonic oscillator variables. So that's the state space, infinite dimensional. That's not perhaps the best way to think about it. Let's think in terms of this so-called Wigner distribution. So the canonical variables X and P describe the phase space, and I want to concentrate on that kind of description. So for the electromagnetic field, E and B, the field quadratures are analogous to the X and P for a mechanical oscillator. And in particular, states of light, here's in a rotating frame that's rotating at the frequency of either the mechanical oscillator or the optical field. This is a so-called coherent state. Electric field looks like that. The position of the oscillator looks like that. And the size of that ball is just one unit of vacuum uncertainty. But of course, the quantum optics community for many years has made states that look like that, squeeze states. So what about squeeze states of motion and light? That's where we're trying to get. For the moment, let me remind you about some possibilities with light. There's this well-known paper by Zembudowski and Rosen where they describe the collision of two particles that lead to an interesting correlated state in position and momentum. It's actually possible to do that experiment not with particles, but with light. And the idea is to let two of these squeeze states collide. They collide at a linear optical element, quite remarkably, not nonlinear, and out comes these entangled beams. And those beams are the realization of that paper. Not the Bell Bohm, but the real McCoy. As was first suggested by Margaret Reed and Peter Drummond, and we implemented an experiment in 1992. So you can think about that then, not in terms of just doing this old experiment, the Gedanken experiment, but actually as a resource for quantum information science. The better you squeeze, the better the entanglement, and you can actually use it for things. And I should point out that although this is continuous variables and most people know more about spins, this really is, by all the tests of non-separability, a bona fide entangled state. So you can make entanglement. How do you measure it? Well, we need to do the equivalent of a Bell measurement. And you just run this backwards. If you have this entangled state that comes to a beam splitter, you can take it apart like that. And that allows you to measure the entanglement, and that's all you really need to do. And we know how to do that with actually exquisite efficiency. One can do these detections. That's in a Homodyne detector measuring the X and the P quadratures with 99% efficiency. There's no post-diction, there's no after the fact. You take it apart and with very high efficiency one can measure those things. And that actually implements what in the context of continuous quantum variables is a Bell state measurement. So I just remind you of this old experiment a few years ago where we did this teleportation. Here's the collision that makes the entanglement. It goes over here. Take it to the unknown state, take it apart at these detectors, and then send it over to there, and out pops that. And that's what the experiment looks like. Still working on that. The idea then is to see what kind of fidelity you can get through the system in initial coherent state, and how good does it come out. And these were our initial measurements of 3 years ago, without entanglement, and now with entanglement, and trying to achieve what we demonstrated in 98, unconditional quantum teleportation. And we've continued to work on that to improve the fidelity. That's not so much the point at the moment as it is now to try to combine these ideas of continuous quantum variables. So here's a harmonic oscillator, trapped particle, where we hope to get. What can we do about this quantum network stuff? Well, I'd like to send that somewhere. So I need Alice and Bob, and they need entanglement. How do I entangle Alice and Bob? Well, I told you briefly about how you do that with this EPR light source. And if I know how to turn light into motion, then I can entangle atoms like that. Well, I've told you the theoretical protocol for how to do that. So now I've got emotional state here, I've got entanglement, entanglement. I just now turn not light into motion, but motion into light. These come out. I do everything that we did in that teleportation, or we're doing in that teleportation experiment, to make a Bell state analysis now not of the material system, but of the material system turned into light. Alice sends the measurement to Bob. Bob does a classical displacement on this particle, and that is the recreation of that now destroyed state. So I think there's a lot of really interesting things to do in this kind of playground of cavity QED, not only with the internal states, but with the center of mass states. In particular, I think this is an avenue towards a whole new kind of nonlinear optics. Never mind quantum information processing. If we can use the really spectacular advances by Dave Wineland's group at NIST, by Rainer Bloch's group at Innsbruck, about control of center of mass motion to make really exotic motional states, a sort that the quantum optics community has not been able to make for 20 years of trying, if we can use those ability to make those motional states, and now, in the way that I told you, at least schematically, make the motional states, turn them into light, and also measure those light states. So I think there's a whole set of possibilities. I told you about this EPR and teleportation, but there's all kinds, think of other really exciting things. So just to conclude, this is the strong coupling. I told you the experiments I told you about are here. We started kind of 20 years ago, and we've been able to push these critical numbers down, you know, 10 to the 8, 10 to the 6. And that's the kind of place we're trying to get in a few years with the technology I've been showing you. We think we ought to be able to get 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 3. And then these little cavities are through. I think we can do a lot of interesting physics, but what's beyond that? Well, I hope we'll hear, and I hope you're aware of the really beautiful work that's being done here in combining photonics, semiconductor cavities, and excitonic physics for cavity QED, or semiconductor cavities and atoms to make very, very small structures and keep pushing this curve down, down, down. It's altogether sensible to project in the coming 5 or 10 years that this curve can continue down 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 8. So, thank you.
Time for a few questions. Fritz?
And according to the trajectory of an atom,
okay, so how far are we from what I would call the standard quantum limit? Is that okay to say it that way? If we could, excuse me? For the translational motion. First of all, I should have said in those movies, if we didn't respect the fact that the field is quantized, that this internal degree of freedom is quantized, well, then you get completely the wrong answer. So that's already important. The question is, when can we see the the quantum character translational motion? If the movie lasted about 3 times longer, or if we had about 3 times better efficiency, said either way, then we would begin to have that happen. And so that, on the one hand, is a question of efficiency. The most stupid efficiency in the cavity is half the light goes that way, and half goes that way. They're equal mirrors. So fixing that, and there's a new experiment we're building. And so we're a factor of, depends exactly how you calculate it, but 3 or 4 away from the standard quantum limit. And in this new experiment, I hope we'll begin to reach that. And then we'll see. Part of the interest in this quantum feedback is the notion that if we really are reaching the standard quantum limit and the ball is getting bigger, well, how do we really know that? There's no independent way. There's no microscopy. There's no technique to tell us what's the right answer for that. And the idea is, well, okay, let's just take a model where we implement this feedback control and we do or do not take account of the fact that we think there's back action noise. And the impact of the feedback in those two cases would be very different. So that's an avenue for investigating those questions.
Carlo.
Yes. So this is a photonic band gap material. There are different incarnations. This is one that Axel Scheer is actually spectacularly successful at making. And one can imagine combining those cavities, which might have Qs of 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5, which is equivalent to the finesse for things like that, to get saturation photon numbers towards 10 to the minus 8. And now you can do that either with excitonic systems, or, well, I don't, those damn things are too complicated. let's just take and trap an atom using lithographically patterned wires and trap atoms in the near field distribution of those cavities. And in that setting, you can at least estimate 10 to the minus 7 to the minus 8. So I think those are actually very exciting, but they're just too complicated for an old guy to think about. So there's a world community of young, smart people doing that.
What's the progress in complete state?
Complete relative to the spin system?
Complete, say, platonic dot state.
Well, for the continuous variables, we've already done that. We did that 3 years ago.
Yeah, so
with respect to the internal degree of freedom, we actually the progress is hope. We have to actually localize these atoms in the cavity. And then there are protocols, which are actually fairly straightforward. The notion that we shine light in and we learn very quickly, more quickly than you could by spontaneous emission or other techniques, what the state of the system is. I mean, there are protocols. We certainly have not implemented them. We've got to get that atom sitting where we know it. The center mass state well controlled, and then it ought to be fairly straightforward to do those kind of things, but we certainly, nor has anybody else done that yet.
I have one question. The rate of enhancement of optical information in the cavity at the microscope, can we think of that as due to the Purcell effect, enhanced decay of the atoms that they emit more photons that they would see in the space?
The simplest way to think about it is not exactly the Purcell effect, which is just this, that an atom in free space, you know, emits at some rate, and now if you put a cavity around it, you're able to capture all that spontaneous emission and an enhanced decay rate. That by itself tells you part of the story, but then you would say, well, I got this right, just keep cranking up the driving field. And so you have to, you know, there is a limit to how much information you can get out of the system. But the G squared over kappa is just exactly that Purcell effect. But what, you know, how much can, when you're driving the system, how much are you allowed to drive it before it saturates? So there's an interplay of information and disturbance, which you kind of have to balance. And you do get that same answer. So a large part of the story is just that. That's right.
Let's thank you again.